Hi. I've known Denise since sometime in the 1970s. I remember being invited to her house when I was an undergraduate poet to read with a group of other poets who, a San Francisco poet, I've forgotten his name, was coming through town, and she got a group of writers together, and that was my first time meeting Denise. And I would say that's typical of Denise, to be interested in getting other Kansas writers together she published two anthologies of Kansas poets through Cottonwood Press, which she was poetry editor of and editor of, and I have been now poetry editor of Cottonwood for, well, since 1984, you do the math, okay, long time. She's published many collections of poetry. Often the poems are centered in Kansas, focused on landscape, focused on people, focused on Native American traditions. She put together a collection of William Stafford poems specifically about Kansas for Woodley Press. And her latest collection, which she just handed me, Natural Theologies, Essays about Literature of the New Middle West, seems an extension of that. That is to go beyond the Kansas border to work on a text about Midwestern writers, Clough Corn and Diane Glancy and all sorts of others from not just from Kansas, but the Midwest. And you told me it's the first collection, as you know, about Midwestern writers. You know, almost could be Great Plains writers. Right? Please welcome Denise Lowe. She's talking about sensory type topologies, Ken Irby's Atlas to the World.
Thank you very much. And again, it's good to greet you all. And many of you came back after lunch. Thank you. That's special. And we appreciate the Eberhardt, University of Kansas English Department, and most of all, Kenneth Irby, the birthday boy. And I'm going to be using references, and they are to this book. Poetry icon, Kenneth Irby, creates text of sensory typographies, and so he has changed technology of the page. I remember his longtime publisher, John Moritz of Tansy Press, fussing about Irby's long lines and the gap-toothed spacings and typography and original illustrations, all the ways Irby pushed the limitation of ink, paper, and binding. This was decades ago, and I still see John grumbling as he midwives some of the most remarkable writing of our time. This has not gone unrecognized. The Poetry Society of America selected Irby as co-recipient of the Shelley Memorial Award in 2010. This establishes him as a major poet among other winners, Robinson Jeffers, Marianne Moore, Robert Duncan, and Robert Creeley, to mention a few. Irby also won the Gertrude Stein Award in Innovative American Poetry and a Fulbright Fellowship. The collected poems, The Intent On, covers 44 years, 1962 to 2006. The squarish, dense tome is blocky and weighty until opened. Then dynamic axes of typography rise from inert materials to create a map at least the size of the known world. Irby is particular about the way his verse looks on the page, how it sounds in the ear, and what stories refire with his calibrated vocabularies. Because the printed page is stationary, it changes context as time moves around it. When performed, many variables arise. Whether silent or performed, no reading is the same river of words. Irby exploits the paradox of composed verse, its simultaneous dynamism and stasis. George Buttrick uses the term interwoven incremental associations to describe Irby's in-motion structures. Words do not suspend in co-equal solutions. Rather, they impel engagement. They locate readers in geographies of real and confabulated places. Pierre Joris identifies the twinning of real and imagined territory in Irby's work as congruence. Let me there. Between that dizzyingly wide open outside space, in capitals as Olson spelled it, and a just as wide and even more unrecognized, at least by me, post-Rambodian, post-Artodian inner space. Irby describes the design of one of his long poems, Kansas, New Mexico, as, quote, spokes of a wheel, the center hub of which is never given, only implied. The Lakota word for the divine is wakan, or mystery, and this helps me understand Irby's implied hub, which can never be understood by rational means. A selection of spokes in an Irby piece can suggest some characteristics. A few radii in this study are storytelling, the body itself as an extended geography, allusions to writers and artists, letters, glyphs, images, etymologies, and complex page layouts. Irby is a storyteller, discovering shards of narrative to assemble in co-creative moments with readers. I asked a Lawrence friend and critic, Jonathan Mayhew, to describe Ken's work in a few sentences. I caught him in a weak moment at Teller's on a bar stool. And he selected the storytelling aspect as a primary characteristic, especially the shift from his own to the narrator's, the various narrators' voices. The work is polyvocal as well as polylogic. I think of Irby's poems as continuations of his conversations, which recount remarkable episodes dramatized with flourish. And drama is not an exaggeration. Butterick describes this aspect of narrative in Irby's work. There's a progression rather than a surrealistic simultaneity of images. Images advance with compound interest. I first fell in love with Irby's poetry in my 20s when reading To Max Douglas. This long poem elegy immediately evokes pathos as it references Percy Shelley's Adonais, an elegy on the death of John Keats. The death of a promising young poet is its storyline. And it begins, "We hiked the long late Sunday afternoon, the Bloomfield Downs of South Sonoma Hills. David said, 'Did you know Max Douglas is dead of an overdose?'" And so, time, place, conflict, elements of narrative arise, but then Irby extends the storyline with reflections on geologies, the Western movement, Ezra Pound, drug culture, the Shelley poem, the classical age of Rome, and more. Each specificity connects to a vibrant webwork of knowledge. The folding of momentary journal-like instances into the larger timeline is important in Irby's writing. The Max Douglas poem continues, "I was just about to ask you about him anyway, I said. That was right there, so far away and lame. We stopped to get across the fence." The detail of stopping to cross a fence, presented casually as perhaps coincidence, shows how the moment of tragic news mars and marks the moment, setting it apart from all other moments in the unfolding of linear sequence. The world stops. Also, the fence is a boundary between innocence and knowledge of mortality. With Irby, we step outside in closed knowledge to discover what? I have noticed, rather than resolve the poem with a resounding click, Irby opens it up to new questions. The poet prescribes no answers, but rather impels more participation in ongoing explanations. And I think, Joe, that is where you and I kind of converge in our many, one of many places and points. Another Irby value is that of personal engagement. I recall Irby's apt criticism of a well-known poet. He noted that, however erudite the man was, he excised all details of his life experience from the verse. Focus on objects alone can result in sterility. I think, therefore, of Charles Olson, who encouraged writers to invest personally in their poems, suggested most strongly in These Days, "Whatever you have to say, leave the roots on, let them dangle, and the dirt, just to make it clear where they came from." Irby retains the dirt, the roots, the bedrock, and all the living systems connected. He does not remove himself, the flesh and blood man. When reviewing Robert Kelly's work, Irby stated what he also could have said about his own. It is that movement into the world that is so strong a breath out of this book that I don't know finally how to separate the poems and the earth they mingle part of. In To Max Douglas, land formations parallel the body's structures with attention to the heart. Because the poem's narrator, with measurements of ribcage and belly pit, has a heart, certainly the land has a heart also. The geology provides observable models for human bone, teeth, nails, circulatory system, and organs. Edward Dorn connects Irby to his body as he experiences language. No matter how far his body wanders, he never wanders. That he is a fixed point of consciousness, which remains steadfast. Irby creates the tension of a nomad who nonetheless inhabits a home, and that home is ultimately his own body, as it steps across a fence or hikes or stops to take in a view. Excerpting Irby's poems is particularly difficult because of the resulting truncation of broad arcs. Nonetheless, here's a later swatch of To Max Douglas. The survey baseline of Northern California anchors on Mount Diablo, the survey spread of the hand held out, the Nogwatch, half leans on the line, on through the eyes, what all trace you make, moving through one whole day. There's an equivalence of hair for all those weeks of Jed Smith tacked north along the Sacramento River. All these pathways lead back to the human body, spread of hand, the eyes, the hair. Jedediah Smith, another through line of the long poem, is the first settler American to travel up the Pacific coast to Oregon, and here the journey of his body across the map traces a trail, a nautical tack. The orientation of surveyed land overlays the geologic, two sliding rock beds that form in Irby's large view, the hand held out, body is landscape again, and the Hopi Nogwatch image. This indigenous image represents two men shaking hands from a dance gesture. It can be abstracted in designs as overlapping curves or interlocking angular curves. In parallel to this glyph, Mount Diablo lies at the convergence of upthrust and slip thrust fault lines. Its peaks appear as a double pyramid from most Bay Area viewpoints. Irby suggests all these aspects in one polysemic image. I posit that no piece of his 600-plus page opus does not reference a place, and most directly, as the titles iterate, Kansas, New Mexico, the grasslands of North America, the headland of Lesser Asia. Irby is an omnivore of place, from humble to grand. Yards, the roadrunner that crossed my yard, 1964. Sewers. Moss in the gratings of a sewer grate, 1965. Famous mountains, west in the mist, Tamalpais top floated, 1977. Sidewalks, the sidewalks are all dried out after the rain, 1999. And parking lots, as we've heard before. I had talked to Denise Lowe in Alvin's parking lot that evening, 1999. My favorite line, of course, in all of Irby, no question. Indeed, his place includes the sweep of continent. In the eye circles and seeks in the long map of California, a rest along the Central Valley, looks down, keeping the corners out, open toward New Mexico and the high plains north, old watersheds east and back again of the spirit journey looking for home. The spirit journey looking for home is Odysseus, is Irby, is each of us traveling through biological sequence. This, as the crow flies view, encompasses the American continent west to east, culminating in the imaginative place of home. In a recent documentary about Yellowstone Park, Confederated Salish and Kootenai spokesperson Jermaine White made the statement that all landscape features of Yellowstone have tribal narratives associated with them. Likewise, in his poems, Irby creates stories about all the places he inhabits, his many folk I called home, Bowie, Fort Scott, Lawrence, Berkeley, New Mexico, Tufts, Denmark, and all the trajectories. He elaborates home in as many ways as he can. Charles Olson wrote of geographic expanses that challenge Americans who must contemplate journeys even if they do remain static. I take space to be the central fact of man born in America from Folsom Cave to now. I spell it large because it comes large, large and without mercy. It is geography at bottom, a hell of wide land for the beginning. Some men ride on such space, others have to fasten themselves like a tent stake to survive, as I see a Poe dug in and Melville mounted. I would say Irby is both a writer and a staked man, according to critic John Latta. And Irby, one thinks, in a sod house, dug in and mounted, traversing, uncertain wandering, the oceanic prairie. Static and dynamic, fixed and mutable, these are continuous and contradictory motions in Irby's prosody. Geography is ever-present. His lines resemble geologic strata. As Mike Madonna observes, as Irby's lines pile into strata, seemingly geological forces fracture the layers and puncture the boundaries between dream, myth, and reality. Fossilized particulars are pushed in by the waves and stranded by the outgoing tide, like trash on the beaches of our attention, opening surprising vistas that endlessness of every day. This is precisely eternity. Another axis of Irby's writing is allusions to other writers, historians, artists, and philosophers. Epigraphs throughout the books, both at the beginnings as dedications or inserts within his own text, are a study in themselves. They create a robust subtext. I learned about many authors in Irby's pages, Carl Sauer, James Malin, other historians of the American West, the Robert poets, Duncan Kelly and Creeley, Charles Olson, Ed Dorn, Theodore Enslin, John Moritz. I cannot read all his sources as he embeds his experience of individuals into the verse and not just selected quotations. He includes narrative moments from their lives. He quotes Olson at the beginning of movements sequences, for example, and then he also embeds an apparently autobiographical event. A week before, Charles Olson had taken me down into his kitchen and offered me some of his cooking oil, soybean oil, and I'd said, "No, you've only got a little left. I don't want to take your last. I'll be getting some more soon anyway." This poem goes on to include the narrator turning down another offer, and so the plot evolves. This Olson event is as significant as the quotation, and many shared moments with other people are essential to the text. The two Max Douglas selection we looked at opens with David informing the narrator of the death, and that person and all the persons in the text add to the narrative, to specificity, and to humanizing the quotations. No detail of the Irby books is haphazard. The poet selects punctuation marks deliberately, and he selects his own marks, omitting others. In Two Max Douglas, for example, Irby indicates pauses to readers by using commas. He questions. A question mark occurs in Interstate 80, for example, but nowhere in the poem does he stop. He never uses a period, and so constant dynamism occurs in apparently resting landscapes. Interstate 80, especially the Arch of Nevada. Under the arch of the ribcage, the redwood seedling sprouts. The year of living in California nurture its garden in the heart, as well as Kansas and New Mexico all at once, as Freud saw all the ages of Rome superimposed in one vision, as on the palm or heartbeat, strings across the belly pit of the basin west. Freud superimposed in one vision of multiple ages exactly Irby's point, and the question mark destabilizes the certainty of linear space, the highway. The lack of a final end stop further destabilizes all the meanings. Elsewhere, Irby uses brackets, dashes, quotation marks, underlining, hyphens, colons, three small stars in a row, italics, and long lines. Lots of brackets, by the way. but not periods ever, not even for abbreviations. I don't find semicolons either, the punctuation mark that is a soft period. Irby selects his own signage from the toolbox of type. All marks on an Irby page, however, lead to the most unresolved organic experience, inhabitation of a body which experiences one final period in death. At all other times, the body and mind are in motion, like Irby's verse. I have not found a period in any of the intent on, excluding the prose pieces. Irby needs more than the Roman alphabet to explain his expansive ideas. In addition to the Nakhwach, he references other native glyphic traditions in a petroglyph-inspired section of Catalpa. The front matter acknowledges other drawings are by the author, some based on reproductions of petroglyphs and pictographs. Most of these are anthropomorphic, stressing again the human form as a reference point. Irby also uses Chinese characters within his alphabetic texts. A quotation of Lao Tzu is among the opening inscriptions for call steps, planes, camp stations, consistories, in both characters and English translation. The prose section of Catalpa that begins, "The students from Krakow leave," includes an Chinese glyph, the character xin, or mind heart. The symbol is drawn with four or sometimes three brush strokes. This symbol is one he annotates in that piece, and I quote, "February piercing the heart and setting the pericardium afire till it walked a striding burning scene, mind heart becoming in the stretch of distance and snow such an eye." In Irby's own drawings, which often accompany his inked signatures of books, he often adds his own character. A circled dot with three teardrops below. These resemble the three downward strokes of the scene, perhaps, but I hesitate to limit any mark by Irby to denotative strictures. In the original edition of Call Steps, and in the reprint in Intent On, the three teardrops appear after the obituary notice of James Malin. These accentuate heartfelt grief expressed for the death of the esteemed Plains historian. Discussion of glyphs appears in Olson's Mayan letters, but he does not integrate glyphic figures into his own verse. Irby reaches beyond conventional typography to use often a circled star as a section divider, with subsections divided with small vertical diamonds. A few variations occur. In the 1992 edition of Call Steps, the stars are simple asterisks. As early as 1971 and 74, the circle star appears in the first two editions of Two Max Douglas. And in 2009, it or the diamond consistently replaces asterisks from previous editions in all of the Intent On. If you're lucky enough to have Irby sign a book, he embellishes his remarkable commentary with small drawings, almost always with a circled star. And these are three examples from my collection, 1984, a typescript poem, Marginalia, 1999, from a signature on Psychos, and the other from an envelope I received in a personal letter dated 2005. This symbol reappears consistently through the decades. In recent conversation, Irby suggested the symbol reference that was not confined to Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. Circle dot is another one of the wingdings, and in Orexis, his own face becomes part of this glyphic presentation. Irby also includes his own drawings in the visual commentary, which also adds to this, the place where the reader's body touches the collection of thoughts sent back through time from Ken Irby. And this is the back of the Intent On. Some years ago, Irby showed me one of his journals. I marveled at all the drawings peppered through the text. I recall he said that he made a drawing each day, if at all possible. And these are all some other examples of inscriptions and extension of the given text with the drawn text. And especially in this one, you see that this was left. This is a whole other study, would be the field of the page. And I'm not going to try to attempt this. This would be a much larger study. But this example represents the four-pointed arrangement on the page. The stanzas weight the corners and so accentuate the dimension of a page. And then in this introduction to Catalpa, we have that clearly this reads like a dictionary, and then the definitions are folded into the text. Trying to work with all of this information, George Quasha notes Irby's availability of memory in the poetics, and this is another angle of traction. And Quasha says the use and subversion of memory is therefore a key to his work, establishing a strange complementarity active in the mind of the reader. Now you're asked to remember a promising detail, now you're oddly thwarted. And The Intent On is a work of mixed genres, beginning with the 1960s, but from Irby I learned space as not simply empty distance or blanks on a page, but rather to essential to intervals among landmarks. And Irby's opus is, like any map, subject to the micro lens of fractals. Upon a close examination, trajectories can unfold endlessly, and this paper suggests only a few. This is the frustration of an atlas. It can never be complete, but then that allows for the slippage, the human creation of reality through typographic representations of topography. Each reading of reality with its unique compass setting and moment on the clock energizes a new morning of creation. And let me indulge myself in wishing Ken a happy birthday with this.